totally acoustic, a home for unamplified music. Not plugged in, mic'd up or now, that's what it's totally about and why it's called Ooh, Totally Acoustic.
It's going to be a good series, I think. I think
this is the most alumni-filled version of Totally Acoustic we've ever had as well. One, two, three, four. So there's at least four people here who play Totally Acoustic. That's a higher percentage than the Tories got in the election. An overwhelming mandate, I think. So the next act, the first act we've got this evening, hasn't played Totally Acoustic before. I played them several years ago, yeah, in distant Croydon, and thought, he was great. I'll get him to play Totally Acoustic, then forgot to do it for several years. But did you email me, or did I email you, or something else? Yeah. And then I thought, oh shit. So please welcome to the station. He was great and is well worth several years, mate. Please welcome Mr. Ben Kosh. Yeah.
Right before our boys were born. So this is I wrote three lullabies for our boys, and we do a couple of them tonight, and Amy's singing with me. And this is a song called Pirates and Dinosaurs, and right before Jamie was born, Amy decorated his bedroom with some gorgeous, really expensive, but gorgeous wallpaper it was only a small wall, we could get away with it. It was bright red stenciled aeroplanes all over the wall, and it was just lovely. And so, being a lullaby, this is a song about bedtime. And picking an aeroplane, really.
Dedicate
it to Pirate Teddy, who's growing inside my best friend's belly and really excited to be with me. The evening is over. It's time to lay down. Put your head on my shoulder, and I'll carry you around. Tell you stories about pirates and dinosaurs and blue racing cars and faraway countries that we'll explore, guided by only the stars. And tell you how loved you are. So find yourself an airplane and fly away to your dreams. Don't you worry about the rain. It's not as bad as it seems. And if you feel that you need someone, just call out for me and I'll sit down beside you, sing you to sleep, let you know that you're my precious one. May find I stay for a while, quietly next to your bed, and hoping for maybe a glimpse of a smile, and counting every hair on your head, rocking you gently and whispering nursery rhymes as the moon passes by, knowing that these are truly the golden times, and they'll be gone in the blink of an eye. But I'll remember them all my life. So find yourself an airplane and fly away to your dreams. Don't you worry about the rain. It's not as bad as it seems. That you need someone, just call out for me and I'll sit down beside you, sing you to sleep, let you know that you're my precious one. tell you stories about pirates and dinosaurs and blue racing cars under the stars. Under the stars.
This is a song that's called The Day We Went on Trisha. Trisha, you may remember, Trisha was kind of the Jeremy Kyle of her day. And couples would go on and sort of yell at each other for 20 minutes, and then that'd be it, really. And this is a song that is, this is told from the gentleman's perspective in that arrangement. It's called The Day We Went on Trisha. Thank you. You yelled at me again tonight. Another silly, stupid fight. You said this time your tether's gone. Just can't let this carry on. You found somewhere that we could try to figure out all of the reasons why. And so we went and found this place. And they put makeup on my face. And I realised that we were on TV. And Trisha was your counselling queen. Sitting in this big blue chair, wondering what the bloody hell I was doing there. I mean, I'd always thought you've got to be mad to bear your soul to Richard and Judy, brackets Philip and Holly, close brackets, daytime TV brainwash show. The lights went up and the music played, and our sorry tale it was relayed. Trisha said, now be honest and true and tell us something that gets under your skin and really gets to you. So I said, your knickers on the floor, because I'm a bloke and I couldn't think of anything more. And then it was your turn. And you said, you've been toenails in the bath to bed, and while you're on the phone, dirty smelly socks and trainers walking on their own, because they memorise the routes down to the offie and the pub, the kebab shop on the corner and the late night snooker club. All the magazines and videos that I buy to watch with you would make Anne Summer's toes curl, they're so crude and rude and blue. Oh, the stripped down engine in the lounge and always wound you up, but I can't believe you're still so mad about the oil in the cup that you mistook for coffee and you drank it all right down, and then you threw up for an hour. And I never buy you flowers lest I've done something wrong and somehow actually realise for a change my jokes are really boring, all my clothes look a bloody same. I'm uncaring, I'm responsive, my emotions are repressed. I'm a twat, a prat, a muppet, and you're really quite depressed. Oh, my mother smells of wee and moans about everything you do. And my dad just stares at your tits every time he talks to you. Their attitude is all my fault, and it's always been this way. I thought you might be finished, but you have one more thing to say. I don't understand your body, and I make love like a buffoon. And you've never had an orgasm with me in the same room. And then Trisha said, so why do you stay with him then? And you said, oh, 'cause I love him, Trisha. And then it was the adverbs. Thank you. Just to clarify, I've never actually been on Trisha. My mother doesn't smell of weed.
No, she doesn't.
I'm not going to say anything about my dad. I'll sing another lullaby. Thank you for listening. If you like this stuff, there is a website at benkosh.net. I used to bring CDs to gigs, but the last time I did it, I bought 12 and I went home with 15 and I decided I'm not going to do that anymore. Yeah. This is the last one. It's another one of the lullabies for the boys.
your eyes now. It'll be alright. Close your eyes now. It'll be alright. We'll be with you. We will be with you. We will be with you through the night. Wrap your arms around. Settle down now, baby boy. Wrap your arms around. Settle down now, baby boy. You will always be. You will always be. You will always be our love, our life, and our joy. Our love, our life, and our joy. You will always be.
Other legends of indie. I've read by a webpage, that's what it says. Coming up, so please welcome, and bona fide various relations of indie, Mr. David Callahan.
I did not heed the plainest of warnings, nor indeed the glimmer of morning. Its steam engine smoke and chimney ash appeared an apparition. On his head a stovepipe hat, in his teeth an exploding cigar, on his shoes spats to keep the cack off. Thus I beheld the apparition. And he carried a cane, silver-tipped, hard and heavy, to punish those who knew not their place, wise to the ways of the lower orders and the liberties and the piss they take. Green flesh on the turn, the smell was strong, though his scent was once so refined. He put a finger and thumb in a hole in his skull and gave me a piece of his mind. You had your chance, little man. You had all the breaks a poor boy can. but you threw the natural order out of whack. Thus quoth the apparition, and alack, I must take it back, the power with which I entrusted you. Alas, it has come to pass that I should never have trusted you. In a world so rich, it is your own fault if you can't find something to eat. And with tacks and twine and an old seat cover, you can make some shoes for your feet. But don't raise a body above their station if you don't want the trains to be late. This the wisdom passed down by his mother, along with the keys to the estate. His tailcoat's claw, his club's come abund, the tie of his education. An echoey voice, a sword stick gaze, behold an apparition. An echoey voice, a sword stick gaze, behold an apparition.
It's a buzzy cheap guitar. The money in the way.
Still remaining strangers. meadow while the cats, the rats, the pigeons and the foxes, the bins and the litter, and the cardboard boxes. No, no, never done nothing. Stood in the first queue, London, waiting. No, no, never done nothing. Stood in the bus queue, London, waiting. The way stays the same, but the world moves on. Students graduate and the cops get young. Kids grow out of clothes every 6 months or so, but I am become one with a matte and glossy coat. No, no, never done nothing. Stood in the same spot, never got running. No, no, never done nothing. Stood in the same spot, never got running. Cars fly past at speed, then incremental buses, suicidal bicycles, chased by incidental lorries. I'm protected in a golden dome all day of London flame pollen and petrol haze. No, no, never done nothing. Free radicals will get the blood pumping. No, no, never done nothing. Free radicals will get the blood pumping.
Take the misery away from you after that.
Okay.
How are you doing for time?
Yeah. It's all good.
I've been to last 15 minutes, so.
On the podcast.
Oh, right, okay. You're going to produce me, are you? All right. Right here. Zone.
red pumper shoes, an itchy beard, and I won't pay a partner who thinks I should be rich, who's equal when it suits her, thoughtless when we fall to bits.
Talking to many people at the same time in the same room as them, so just be discreet, pretend you're not here, and enjoy the vocals. So people said to me, he's not fucking singing, is he? No, he's not singing, it's alright. Please welcome to the stage, Mr. Steve Lamatt.
Having said that, when we did start Six Music, this was our entire audience when we first went on air. And yes, I'm not going to sing. I've only ever sung once on a stage when I did backing vocals for Attila the Stockbroker, who was a ranting poet, some of you remember, Attila the Stockbroker. And it was in Oxford in the very early 80s, and the only reason I sang backing vocals with him, I was roadieing for him at the time. And can I recommend, if you ever get a roadieing job, roadie for a poet. That's make sure he's there on time, and then you take the lectern. There you go, done. Job's actually done. I actually roadied though for for Idlewild once. Yeah, at the Tea in the Park festival in Scotland, and that did involve getting up quite early, pushing amps around and everything. We recorded it for the radio, as it goes. And so I was Rod Jones, their guitarist, guitar tech for the day. The only advice I was given by the tour manager was don't drop the guitar. But you have to do that thing where, if you're the guitar tech, and you've seen guitar techs, all of you, you have to assume that weird position, which is you have to squat by the amp. You're either on stage or off stage. You squat by the amp, you wait there, and then Rod makes a sort of gesture, and you stand up and take his guitar, don't drop it, give him his guitar, and then you go back to squatting by the side of the stage. And this was weirdly, it was just after my old programme on Radio 1, the evening session had been axed. And I got a lovely letter about a week later from somebody saying, Steve, I never realised times were so hard. Anyway, Mark's been very kind enough to let us do this tonight. There may or may not be, depending on how well tonight goes, a one-man show next year, which is what I've been working on, which is called Going Deaf for a Living, the story of a music fan. And it's not my story, exactly. There are some of my stories in it. But I worked out a long time ago that us as music fans, and the fact that you're out on the school night, means that we are slightly obsessed by music and a different sort of culture. And if that's the case, then we've all shared certain experiences by being a music fan. We've been through highs and lows, the disappointments, the absolute triumphs. We have fought for the bands that we liked. We have been disappointed when they have let us down, of which more later on.
But that's what it generally is about, because we all start off, we all start at the same point. We all start with the first song, the first single we buy, or the first song that means something to us, whether it's on the radio, you take it off the radio. And then it's the first gig, and the first gig is really important, I think, because the first gig is a rite of passage, and it doesn't matter where we come from, where we grew up, who the gig was by, what it was actually like, who you went with. It doesn't really matter. We have all had shared experiences of that first gig, which was, I was 13 years old. It was in 1978. My favourite punk band at the time were a group called The Lurkers, who were once described as Britain's answer to the Ramones. Just once. They announced a gig at the Chancellor Hall. The Chancellor Hall was not known for doing gigs. They had odd folk bands playing there. The Spinners would play there. They would put on wrestling. There'd be a cabaret event. But the Lurkers announced that they were playing the Chancellor Hall. And I was over the moon. But you have to convince your parents at the age of 13. So being quite devious even then, I went to my mum and dad and I said, there's a band playing a concert. Band playing a concert. Nothing wrong with that. So I sent off for the ticket. My ticket arrived. It was 00012. That makes me really special. I must be the biggest Lurkers fan. I must be a part of the elites because I've got ticket 00012. It doesn't occur to me that Lurkers aren't very popular anywhere in Britain, particularly in Essex. But I look at that ticket for 2 weeks and then the big day comes. And this is what I mean. I imagine your first gigs, whatever your first gig was, there is a point on the day when you're thinking, what do I wear? What do I go as? I've never been to a gig. It's not exactly like going to a bookies for the first time. But there's an air of mystique. And as a 13-year-old growing up in a tiny little village in Essex, my schoolboy wardrobe didn't have a lot of things that I thought, this will look really good. Although, ironically, if I had gone in the school uniform with a skinny tie, it fitted right in. But as it goes, I spent the whole afternoon, virtually. At least there was a point where I spent 2 hours. And I remember very vividly my mum coming in at one point, sensing that I was in crisis, and saying, what about the little tweed thing that you wore at Grandad's at Christmas? I found something slightly scruffy, and this is something that we possibly share as well. Has anyone here ever had to get a lift with their mum and dad to a gig? You spend the entire time trying to work out where they're going to drop you off. Please don't drop me off outside. Please don't pick me up outside the venue. My mum and dad, unfortunately, drove past the Chancellor Hall, where a meagre queue of Essex punks were, and I kid you not, dressed in bin bags with dog collars around their necks. People did actually used to do that. Of course, having a ticket, I stood in a queue, and then a bouncer came out and said, anyone with tickets can go straight through. I'm one of the elite. I can do this. And I was watched with scornful looks, because no one's bought a ticket for this, because they're all punk rockers. But the thing is, what do? When we were young, what time do you get to Paul McCartney? You've probably got them doors open.
The bus drops us off, yeah.
So, what did we do? It's 7:30. We can't drink. I've gone on my own. I don't know what I did. I stood around for a bit, obviously, and then the support band, the Sods, the Sods came on. I stood right at the front and the singer spat on my head. That's absolutely true. And the Lurkers went on, and it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in my life. The singer Howard Wall was wearing this massive long almost fluorescent pink drape, like a teddy boy drape. It was so loud and so exciting. I'd never seen anything or felt anything like it before in my life. And I think that's where I became addicted to gigs. It was just extraordinary. And I went away and my ears rang for 3 days afterwards. But after that, all I wanted to do was go to gigs, and that's all I've probably been doing ever since, really. But I went to all these gigs, and when I finally joined the NME, even at the NME, I was deemed to be a little bit weird because of the amount of gigs that I went to. If we've got time, we're doing the long version of the set. And I hope you can hear this. I went to the NME, and eventually, after 3 years, they made me live editor. Now, obviously, everyone here probably remembers when the NME had words in it. Some of them about music. The NME was very late on Nirvana. Sounds and the Melody Maker had both got there first, really, but eventually we managed to persuade our features editor that we should do something about Nirvana. And just before the time that the single Sliver came out, myself and a photographer called Martin Goodacre, we went down to interview and take photos of Nirvana. The interview is not as interesting as the photo. The photo, which weirdly wasn't used with the piece at the time, is the photo that most of you will now know is the one which was used later on in his life. This was a photo taken that day. It was October 1990. And we went to what was essentially a very, very shabby guest house in Shepherd's Bush. Nirvana were over because they'd already decided that they were going to leave Sub Pop. They were talking to record labels over here. And at the time, before they decided to go with Geffen, the front runners was Island Records, so they were going to sign to Island. But while they were here, they did 4 dates supporting Tad around the country. The first one was in Norwich, at which Chris Novoselic had come down with a terrible cold. So by the time we get to this one room, and they were all staying in one room, it's a grubby guest house with 3 beds in one room and a bathroom. Novoselic does the entire interview with the covers over him.
Unless he says, "Yeah, I agree."
I sat next to Kurt Cobain on the bed, my little cassette Walkman, recording Walkman next to us, Kurt Cobain here, and their new drummer, they just appointed a new drummer, a guy called Dave Grohl, and who was a little bit distracting because Dave was just ferreting around the room, and then as I was asking Kurt a question, Dave Grohl hauls this bin bag past us to the bathroom. The bathroom door being ajar, I can see what he's doing. He takes this bag and empties their socks and underpants into the bath. Dave Grohl washes their underwear. While I'm interviewing Kurt Cobain, he's trying to convince me that terrapins are a great pet to keep. And all the time, on the wall in the background, on a bracket right in the corner, there's a little black and white TV showing The Wizard of Oz. genuinely true. Very surreal. Nirvana, of course, were, and I suppose Kurt Cobain's death particularly reminds us of something else, that we invest an awful lot in the bands, I think, and that's part of what it is being a music fan, that we find people that we trust, we find people that we believe in, we find particularly lyricists who can say something about our life, and when we are all occasionally let down by bands. In fact, and I think we're all old enough in this room now and experienced enough to appreciate that 99% of bands that you believe in will let you down. I'm always interested in new additions to my list of bands and the ways they let you down. Please come forward afterwards and add to these. Your favourite member of the band will leave. The songwriting partnership within that band, the key songwriting partnership, will fall out with each other. They will add an unnecessary keyboard player. They will redesign their logo, possibly in a font that says, "We're up to date." They will spend 5 years soaked in drugs attempting to make their second album. They will announce a 2-year break the week you split up with your girlfriend or boyfriend, and the moment that you need them most, they will be on a 2-year hiatus. And if they do stay together, they will stop playing your favourite song live. You'll go see them, "This is the last time I'm doing this." And they'll never play your favourite song live again. They'll record at least one awful cover version. They will make a concept album, probably about dinosaurs. They will make a concept album about ring roads of Britain. And then after releasing that concept album about the ring roads of Britain and telling you how amazing it was and being on the front cover of all the magazines, doing the broadsheet press and telling you this record is absolutely amazing and this is us at the peak of our game, that will come back with the next record 2 years later and tell you that the previous record, the concept album, was actually bollocks. And that's the album which you've spent 2 years defending. Because you know what it's like as a music fan, you do have to occasionally stand your ground for the bands that you like. You're going to end up in arguments. And this goes back to when we were at school in the playground. I mean, going back to my days when I was at school, and somebody would say, Boomtown Rats are good. Not as good as the Stranglers. Yeah, they are. No, they're not. And these arguments will persist, and you will end up having to stand up for the Stranglers, which is what I did. I carried on standing up for the Stranglers. I carried on buying Stranglers records long after the Stranglers were rubbish. I didn't realise this. I was a Stranglers fan. It was part of the gig. It was part of being a music fan, was being a Stranglers fan. You have to buy the records. I bought Bear Cage by the Stranglers, took it home, got it home from Ipswich Parrot Records, put it on when I got in, listened to it once, listened to it again. And on the third listen, while staring at the sleeves, realised this record was crap. But not only that, apparently, then the previous two records, they were crap at all. Just I've been in denial. This is the problem. Because the thing is, with bands and with the people that we choose to trust and believe in, they do something which we can't do. Dave does something I can't do, and so does Mark. People can vocalise emotions that we can't vocalise. They can express things that we can't express. So we choose to think that they must be the same people as us, that they understand us. That's why we trust in them. That's why we believe in pop stars. But the thing is, they're not us. And at some point, because they're not us, they will do something which we wouldn't do. And that's the point where they'll let us down. And all bands will let you down at some point. Imagine being an Oasis fan when Be Here Now comes out. And even then, having got through that, it's just a blip. It'll be fine. No problem here. Standing on the shoulder of giants. I do quite like Oasis, though. Or I'll tell you, I do like Noel Gallagher, because Noel Gallagher is one of the easiest interviews. I've done some difficult interviews with Noel Gallagher, but Noel Gallagher did give us one of my favourite interviews when he was still vaguely on speaking terms with his brother. Noel came in to do an interview, and at the end of it I said, if you tell me your favourite story about your brother, I'll tell you my favourite story about your brother. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you mine another day. His favourite story, and I hope this is true. I know Noel is very good at spinning things, and I imagine, you know, there's somewhere on the internet this story with somebody else in it, but he claims that this is absolutely true. And Noel Gallagher's favourite story about Liam Gallagher is this, that Liam goes round Noel's house, being a bit rude, goes straight to the fridge to get a beer, opens up the fridge. There's a bottle of champagne, which is not quite finished, and Noel's put a teaspoon in it. And Liam goes, son, well, you put a teaspoon in a bottle of champagne, it doesn't go flat, keeps the bubbles. Basically, put a teaspoon in it, keeps it fresh. Right? Noel says, no word of a lie. I'm round at our kid's house a week later, open up his fridge, bottle of milk with a teaspoon in it. Oasis were at the first Glastonbury festival I ever went to, because I never went to festivals as a kid, because I'm of an age where when I was growing up, festivals, well, Glastonbury was full of hippies, Reading was full of rockers and bikers throwing piss at each other, bottles of piss at each other. In fact, well, I was put off going to Reading because someone who went to school with, his elder brother, went to Reading Festival one year with the bikers. And he said, and they didn't really like it. They weren't really very embracing of metal from around the world, unless it was German. Particularly French bands they hated. So when a band went on and went, hello, we are Trust, bottles of piss, bottles of piss, bottles of piss. So I never went to festivals. Until I had to work them. 1995 was my first Glastonbury festival, and I've had good times and bad times at Glastonbury down the years, but I've learned to love it, really, and find the things which are sort of more warm and human and interesting about it. And I'll leave you with two stories about Glastonbury. One, which you may have heard it because it was on Radio 4. Hugo Rifkind, who's a journalist, spent a day, I think for the Sunday Times, following the police at Glastonbury around. So I don't know if you know, there's a police station, there's a mini police station, a pop-up police station at the Glastonbury Festival. And he said he was being shown around by this guy who just opened the door, and he looked in, and there was just a room of six policemen in front of a huge video screen with a man with a stick pointing at the video screen. The picture on which was three men dressed as Super Mario. he looks in, the people look round, the guy looks at the guy with the stick, and he just shuts the door. And never speak of this again. The other thing, a great thing for me about Glastonbury was getting to work with John Peel down there, and we did a few shows, including the famous night, the Radio 1 show, where John got a bit bored, had a very long drive home, and in our 3-hour special, just before the news, announced to me that would it be okay if I went home early. So we had to do the last hour and a half about him, bless him. But we used to have a great time, because every Sunday we would meet backstage on the Sunday and swap stories about bands that we'd seen, bands that we'd missed, things that were really good. So one year, and it was one of the years that WaterAid, one of the charities that Glastonbury give to, WaterAid were trying to raise their presence at the Glastonbury Festival. So they had people in costume walking around the site, dresses, basically to try and inform people about their work that they did, so they were dressing, you know, with reference to various forms of sanitation and water. And it was that year that John came back. We nicked a couple of bales of hay from Telly, from later with Jules or something. We sat down and I said, John, you look a bit perplexed. He said, if I'm being brutally honest, I've just shaken hands with a turd. And I've never shaken hands with a turd before. Unless you count Noel Edmonds.
That was like DVD extras for my 20s and 30s.
And that was Totally Acoustic, a lovely way to start off the new series. Our next one's on Thursday the 5th of November, back at the King and Queen, when we've got Ivor Game, I Carmella and NJ Hibbett and Lynn. It should be a good night, so I hope to see you there if you want to come. Thanks for listening, thanks for having you played and came to this one, and see you next time.